Kickstart projects that will probably never sell to anyone. But if you're interested, and it's sort of fascinating to see what people kind of come up for. They're trying to solve a problem that doesn't quite exist. So at my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, there'll be a very nice little group of someone actually attempting to do something useful with an electrified plank of wood. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Okie dokie. Also, I like to tell people what's coming up in the sky next Sunday, January 20th. Here in the Western Hemisphere, we'll be able to see the only total lunar eclipse of 2019, dubbed by some the Super Blood Wolf Moon. And there are other people who are rather annoyed with the hyping of it. But anyway, it's going to be the only one. It's going to be next Sunday, so hopefully if you're going to look at it, and I suggest you look at it, because what the heck, it's up in the sky anyway, you do it before the TechNet. Basically, it's called a super blood wolf because of a bunch of things. It's called super because the moon is closest to the Earth. It's called blood because it's a total eclipse, and the refracted light around the Earth discolors the reflection of the moon to be red. And it's called the wolf simply because Indians called the first full moon of January a wolf moon. So anyone out there who has the time, look up next Sunday and see the super blood wolf moon. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, we'll have to look right after the net starts, more or less, because the earliest would be 9:36. That's when it starts, and you get to totality, but later on, 11:41. So, but what's good is in New York, we'll be able to see the whole thing, from, from start to finish. So, if you're up real late, it goes to like 2:45 in the morning. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. So basically, find yourself a window that shows them and listen to the TechNet and look out the window. You can do that simultaneously and won't interrupt your listening pleasure. Talking about the moon, I have a puzzle for you guys. We've talked about the gravitation.
The only thing we need is good weather. I know there's supposed to be possible snow on Saturday.
Fourth.
So hopefully that's over on Sunday.
To the sides of the Earth, with high tides occurring twice a day as well as low tides. And we discussed how the Large Hadron Collider needed to actually adjust their target area due to this tidal force fluctuation. So my question tonight is whether these tidal forces might have any effect whatsoever on the water level of well water located near the coast at the same time as high tide. Do you think the well water rises, falls, or stays the same? It's open for discussion.
WB2GXM.
GXM.
Roy Rich here. I do believe it will stay the same. Water does not expand or compress. Well, I guess it does. Oh, wow. I still say it's going to stay the same. There you go, WB2GX.
Very good. So you have stay the same. Anyone with any other opinions or explanations of what might be going on? VDH? Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I think the groundwater level as well as the tide level would follow the pull of the moon. So just as you're getting a high tide, I suspect the groundwater level would also rise. Go ahead.
Okay, makes sense. So we have one vote for stays the same, one vote for rising. Anyone with any other opinion?
KD2MBB.
Yes, Bob.
I I think it might fall, and it's sort of hunchy. I can't really explain it, but I'm visualizing this possibility that it might actually fall because the water's kind of pulled up. Just maybe chilling. Anyway, that's my move.
Okay, Bob, that's reasonable, but do you have, other than a gut feeling, do you have any kind of physical explanation for why the water might drop? I mean, where is it going?
I just have this visualization of the water kind of going up. This is probably crazy. And then it's got to come from somewhere, so it's kind of draining it down. This may be completely off. But anyway, no, I can't really explain it. But it's just this weird intuitive hunch.
Okay, hunches are good, Bob. Does anyone else have any insight into this question? Rise, fall, or stay the same? Gosh, no more takers. Okay, I will give you a hint. It doesn't, this was a question, not why, but what happened, was answered sometime long ago. Anyone care to roughly approximate when this was first noted? Last Wednesday, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, something like that. Anyone want to kind of throw out a guess of how long ago someone looked down a well and said, gee, it does so-and-so? Gosh, no. Okay. Basically, it was reported, it was written down about over 2,000 years ago by a Greek philosopher called Posidonius. He actually bothered to look down wells during high tides and such and documented the results. I don't think he had the faintest idea, because back then there's a lot of things they didn't really know. This was back in the good old days of Aristotle and such. But it was documented, the effect was documented, the reasoning behind it is still kind of a little bit dubious. Some people believe slightly different variations on it. But once again, anyone else have any kind of suggestions of what might be going on to the water in a given well? Okie doke. Well, Bob was right. The actual well water drops at high tide and rises in low tide. And the reason primarily, most likely, is that the same way that the Large Hadron Collider target has to be adjusted during tidal shifts is because, although the tidal forces have an incredible effect on the ocean, they have a significant effect on granite and rock and other things. And so the concept is that the sediment is pulled apart, leaving empty spaces where water can settle down further. And also there's a local slight elevation in the barometric pressure due to that tidal force that acts to push the well water even a little bit farther. But I think it's primarily the fact that the stone and the sediment stretch a little bit and give more spaces. So that was an effect that was documented back in 100 BC, and the reasons kind of came to us in the last 100 or odd years. But you never kind of think of well water, but that's what happens with well water. Any questions or comments?
QIS query.
Yes, query away.
I am wondering if this effect varies based on the distance from a shoreline. If you dug a well on a beach, I would think that the water in that well, being, you know, not very far away from the water line, would match up much more closely with the tides. ACQIS.
Well, when you say lines up, do you mean that it's more significant in effect, or do you mean that it should be less of an opposite effect?
I would think that if you dug a very shallow well next to a an ocean, that the water in that well should go up and down at the same time as the ocean, right? Just because there's not that much sand in between your well and the ocean. AC2IS.
Well, I might agree with you, although when you kind of separate the water volume away from the total of the ocean, you somewhat diminish the tidal effects. But you certainly would have a really terrible well, because you'd have a well that was probably full of salty water. So most of these have been reports of wells closer to coastal areas. I think there is an effect globally. It's just a little bit more easy to demonstrate near coastal areas, but it works the same way. Near coastal areas, high tide, you look down the well and it's lower. But you have to understand that the well water is not really in equilibrium with the seawater, because otherwise you'd have salty well water.
Well, there are saltwater wells, saltwater aquifers, but that's kind of besides the point. You can, if you just sort of think about this, the tide is rising and falling. You know, if you look on a beach, that sand, you know, it's not rising more than the tide itself. Otherwise, the tide itself would not rise relative to, you know, the shore that you're standing on. So at some point, this must reverse, right? Is what I'm thinking. It's some distance from the shoreline. I don't see how this could, you know, if you somehow were in a, if you were digging a tunnel under water somehow, and if you somehow had the ability to dig a well there, of course, this is all completely nonsensical. The water line would be above your head. You know, what would happen to the well there, like in the middle of the ocean? I don't know. There's something about this that doesn't make sense to me. It seems like there's additional factors here, namely the distance from the shoreline. AC2IS.
Okay, I mean, the problem is that people kind of list two reasons. One is more geographically important than the other. I don't really think the pressure differential of the high tide causes that much of the water to be pushed down, personally. I think the overwhelming driving force in this behavior is the fact that tidal force acts on the sediment to kind of pull it apart, you know, not that much, by a couple of millimeters, but that's enough to open up enough spaces to drop the water level a little bit. Again, we're not talking about the level differences between high tide and low tide in the ocean. We're just talking about whether, you know, if you draw a line on the well and you go back in high tide and low tide and see where it is in relation to that line evaporation not being considered. That's kind of the way I see it, and I understand the rationale behind the answer to it all, that it's a tidal effect on sediments, the fact being that tidal forces affect rocks and other things as well as oceans.
Okay, then let's take that thought experiment a little bit further. If tidal forces are acting on the sediment, and it has more of an effect on the sediment than the water, then if you're out, you know, some distance into the ocean, the tide rises, is the sediment underneath all that water also rising, and rising more than the tide itself? So at high tide, does the ocean get slightly less deep? AC2IS.
I believe that the rise of the water is significantly greater than the rise of the sediment, because water is much more pliable and elastic, if you will, than sediment is. So both of them will be drawn up by the tidal force. Water will be drawn up to a much greater extent than the sediment below it.
Right. So, okay, you're saying that the tide is going to rise more quickly because it's easier for the water to move around in the ocean than it is for, I guess, the dirt to move around. But so when you dig a well, right, what you're really saying is that, okay, the soil itself is impeding the motion of the water, that the, like you say, the water would want to move the same way the tides do, but there just isn't enough water there. You essentially end up with a sort of a, somewhat of a water vacuum at that point, because the water cannot inundate through the land quickly enough to get there and fill up your well, right? But I would think, again, well, maybe the rate of inundation of water through soil is just so low that you can get this effect fairly close to a shoreline. But at some point, there's got to be some transition, right, where the inundation of water from the... effectively what I'm talking about. You know, shouldn't the water from the tides inundate in towards the land, ACTIS?
Okay, unfortunately there was some background noise that knocked out some of what you said. Oceans have large volumes, have large areas, so they have greater obvious tidal effects. Small rivers don't really have tides. Large rivers have some tidal effects as well. So if you cut off a water source from a large area, you're not going to have the tidal effect that you would if you put it in a large ocean, if you will. So those, you know, if it wasn't for the gravitational force of the sediment and the pressure, most likely the tidal force in such a small column of water would have a negligible, non-existent result. It would stay the same. So it's not the water that's demonstrating the tidal force as much as it is the sediment, and because water in small volumes doesn't demonstrate the tidal effect that you see in the ocean, is the best way that I could think of saying it.
All right, no comment on my part. ACTIS.
Okay. Well, I think it's an interesting point. I was kind of surprised to read that it was a gentleman by the name of Posidonius back in 100 BC that came up with that. Those Greeks were clever. Anyway, I will go on with one of my stories right after I drop for a second. Okay. Last year, we discussed the imaginary Russian discovery polywater, if you remember. It was a bit of pathological science that was thought to be a polymerized state of water that could revolutionize technology. In the end, it turned out to be simple water contaminated with chemicals that had not been cleaned from the Russians' glassware. Now, we talked about other examples of pathological science, like phlogiston and luminiferous ether. There were substances in the history of science that seemed too good to be true that were never proved or to exist or disproven either. They were kind of lost to both history and science. Now, one of these was called starlight. It was invented by a retired British hairdresser named Morris Ward. Previously experimented with different hair dyes, but after a major airplane disaster in the 1970s, he was motivated to start to work on better fireproofing material. His solution was called Starlight. It was named by one of his granddaughters, apparently. Initially, the kitchen experiment of a retired hairdresser didn't quite create any excitement, but Morris wangled a slot on a VBS a TV show called Tomorrow's World in the early 1990s, where he wrapped a raw egg in a layer of this off-white putty-like material and blasted a blowtorch at it for the next 5 minutes of the show. At the end of the segment, the insulating material was peeled away to show that the inside of the egg was still raw. Let me drop for a second. Now, this demonstration was very well received, and supposedly NASA, as well as other government agencies and big corporations, were very interested in this wonder material. And Morris remained very secretive about it all. He wouldn't talk about what it was made of. He wouldn't give anyone a sample. He would do his little egg trick to almost anyone who asked, and he began to have press releases that the material could block high-intensity laser attacks, and there was some talk that it could handle the heat from an atomic weapon. There were all kinds of rumors that the material contained a variety of organic polymers and copolymers with organic and inorganic additives, including ceramics. Some said it was made of 21 different chemicals. At first, Morris said that none of his secrets were written down, but then later he reversed himself, saying, of course, he had kept meticulous notes on the substance's development. He also said that he had shared the secret with his family, but after Morris's death, all family members said they had no idea how he made Starlight. Let me drop for a second. Well, that didn't stop the family from selling Starlight technology to a fellow that was planning to build a fireproof suit. Fortunately, that company went up in smoke. It went bankrupt without producing any products. Morris's daughters then tried to resell the invention as a better version than the first customer had paid for, that Morris had told them also about, but so far no one's taken them up on this offer. So why bring this all up now, after Morris has shuffled off his mortal coil and his daughters seem to have already fleeced the only guy left to be fleeced by claims of this stuff? Well, a few weeks ago, a fellow was watching the many YouTubes about this wonder substance, and he thought he remembered playing with something that seems very similar. He tinkered around with his original creation and came up with something that seemed to look and act a lot like the seemingly mythological Starlight. He took 10 parts cornstarch to 1 part bicarbonate of soda and added enough PVA, polyvinyl acetate, to the mixture until it developed the consistency of putty. Let me break for a second. Now, you might ask, what the heck is polyvinyl acetate, and where the hell do you get some? Well, some of you know this stuff better as either white glue, carpenter's glue, or good old Elmer's glue. He took a slab of this stuff, covered a raw egg with it, let it dry for a while, and repeated Morris's old Tomorrow's World performance. He even placed what looked like a tortilla shell of the material in his hand and shot a blowtorch at it with no ill effect. So, is this just some more tube trickery afoot? Well, not at all. Within days, other YouTubers were mixing up their own batches of pseudo-Starlight and repeating the same experiments and successfully burning thermite in crucibles made of this stuff. So how does this stuff actually work? Well, I'm not sure, but people have some good ideas. Let me drop for a sec. Under heat, some of the material appears to combust, and most of the surface seems to be reduced from the cornstarch's long chains of sugar molecules into carbon. The carbon dioxide generated seems to protect the carbon from oxidation, and also seems to form carbon into a fine carbon foam, expanding away from the object it's protected and towards the heat source. Now, carbon foam is an excellent insulator of heat by limiting the convection and conduction path. And because carbon foam is an excellent blackbody radiator, it can also dissipate heat in the form of infrared radiation. So this stuff cools to the touch within seconds of being removed from a heat source. So this wonder stuff actually exists. But then, why hasn't it been commercialized by some obsessive inventor? Now, my guess is that, as wondrous as this material appears, it may have more than a few Achilles heels. It may deteriorate over time, and attempts to keep all of its wonder material qualities may have failed to find an appropriate stabilizer to ward off degradation. It also doesn't seem to have any reasonable strength. Every time I've ever seen it used, it has that putty-like consistency. It's also hygroscopic, apparently, and it soaks up too much moisture. it may ruin its thermal insulating qualities that way. Now, one glaring problem is that although it appears invulnerable to a simple butane torch and acetylene torch that runs a lot hotter, devastated this material, not to mention when they tried an oxyacetylene torch, which just decimated it. Let me drop for a sec. Now, one guy actually showed that you could hold a steel piece of toast in the palm of your hand and shoot it with a blowtorch and not burn his hand. So it only goes to show you that I guess blowtorches are not quite as hot as we like to think they are. But don't do this at home, people. The original YouTuber that disclosed this promised that he was going to return to explain why he thought this product wasn't as good as it mythologically was supposed to be. So I'm kind of looking forward to his follow-up videos. And I've placed a link on roy.ac2gs.com for this YouTube of this gentleman who made Starlight. It's a fascinating material, but it doesn't quite sound like it's the wonder substance that it was cracked up to be. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2IS, comment.
AC2CS.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. I'm wondering if you are familiar with intumescent paint, as it seems to have most of the properties of Starlight, maybe not to the same extremes of being able to resist thermite, but you know, it's effective in much thinner layers, and it does not break down like we're guessing Starlight does. Also, I thought that Starlight was made not with baking soda, but with baking powder. Wondering if I got that wrong? AC2IS.
Well, the way I heard it was bicarbonate of soda.
Okay, I guess I thought one of the things I'd heard about Starlight was that, again, I thought it was baking powder, but basically it produced CO2, and that's what caused you to get carbon foam. Could be wrong about that. But also, isn't it interesting that we all seem to see the same things on YouTube? It seems like there's so much stuff there, but when you are YouTube surfing, it's kind of remarkable how the recommended videos that come up are similar from one person to the next. If you have heard of intumescent paint, please let me know. C2IS.
No, I have not. I'll have to look that up. Well, I think the algorithms kind of take the interesting YouTubes we all find in common interesting, and they spit out these types of things. The gentleman who did the pseudo Starlight, I had already subscribed to. He was doing other strange little chemical conjuring and such. So I had already been watching him. So it wasn't as much a YouTube algorithm as it was I was already on the guy's subscriber list. But yeah, there's a certain number of guys who do these kind of fascinating, unusual things. They present them well. They speak properly. There are some YouTubes where people have their accents, and what's even worse, I found, are the guys who obviously have very thick accents, but they prefer to use a synthetic voice generator, and that just kind of drives my brain crazy. I can't listen too long to a synthetic voice on YouTube, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, on to the next. We've talked before about the mysterious attack on our diplomats in Cuba before. Recently, Vanity Fair released a very entertaining article summing up the disposing of most of the theories that have been proposed for this phenomenon. Now, initially, a sonic weapon was hypothesized since our military had been working on such weaponry in the past. But over time, the experts discounted this, since the military had found, after spending a lot of research money, that the emitter would be enormous and its power supply humongous. There would be no way to slip into a diplomat's residence secretly. The FBI discounted the possibility of it being a sonic attack. Now, remember those audio recordings that the AP obtained and reported on? Well, entomologists or insect experts recognize that sound of particularly loud but relatively harmless species of cricket called the Jamaican field cricket. Now, these critters can get as loud as a vacuum cleaner, but they have not been reported to cause brain damage to anyone yet. The scientists at the University of Michigan and the University in China had yet another suggestion, intermodulation distortion. It was their premise that the ultrasonic signals from everyday devices like burglar alarms or motion detectors act across ultrasonic streams with a secret surveillance system producing those cricket-like sounds, possibly with detrimental effects. Let me drop for a second. Now, unfortunately, the anti-Castro politicians in Congress tended to prefer a more premeditated reason, so they threw out the crickets and the crossing streams and accused Cuba of this ultra-high-tech attack. As you remember, we talked about it. The Journal of the American Medical Association put in their 2 cents worth on a speculative article that ultimately described these cases as immaculate concussions and really left this mystery unanswered. According to a Journal of American Medical Association editorial in the same issue, they pretty much put the whole article in great doubt. Even with the editorial caution, the article elicited numerous attacks of the study by eminent skeptical scientists. Then the New York Times wrote a rather sensationalist theory that this was a microwave weapon utilizing an effect known for 30 years called the Fry effect. Now, the Washington Post responded to that with an article citing people involved in the original research of the Fry effect, and they were labeling such a theory as crazy. Let me drop for a second. Now, this Vanity Fair article, which I will offer a link to on my link page, had a great paragraph. It said, "If you view what happened to the diplomats in Havana as an attack, you must look for something capable of producing such an assault. It would have to emit a sound that varied widely from listener to listener. It would have to strike only people who worked at the embassy. It would have to assail them wherever they happened to be, whether in their homes or staying at a hotel. It would have to produce a wide range of symptoms that seem to bear no relation to one another, and it would have to start off small with one or two victims while spreading rapidly to everyone in the group." Now, the authors of the Vanity Fair piece seem to prefer the reason for all this to be a conversion disorder, better known as mass hysteria. Now, this is all very eerily similar to an excellent article I recently read regarding the 200 people accused of witchcraft and the 25 people killed as part of the infamous Salem witch trials. And there have been a plethora of similar episodes in the past, many of them cited in this Vanity Fair article. Is Vanity Fair right, or is this some clever misinformation scheme covering up a technologically advanced Cuban military lab? Or worse, aliens softening up us for their attack. Check out this article that I have linked at roy.ac2gs. It's a clever and amusing, albeit snarky, article on the subject. Stay tuned to your comics for more about this. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It's a popular topic. It's even made it into a TV show. There's a weekly show called NCIS, you know, a typical cop type of show where, you know, every week they have a different episode. Well, last week they had the episode about people's brains getting fried and they quoted the problem in the Cuban embassy, and they quoted all this. They even talked about the Frey story and on and on. It's just a regular TV show you watch, and I couldn't believe they're going on and on about this. And naturally, they eventually worked it down to, in this case, they said it was microwave, you know, the all, you know, big time power supply and antenna, and they were flying everybody around them. But it's amazing how it worked into regular TV shows. Back to you, Roy, WS2.
Well, Paul, people like conspiracies, and these guys read the newspaper. Unfortunately, there's a bunch of things they tend not to read. I don't know if you watched an episode a year or two ago. They did a whole episode of a crime that involved an amateur radio operator, and they got it almost completely wrong. It sounded like this guy was a citizen's band. They would talk about his handle. There were people who never identified themselves, who were anonymous and had code names. It was a mess. I don't know if you you watched that one, or hopefully you missed it.
Yeah, that was the regular NCIS show. The first one I mentioned is the NCIS LA. You know, they have different places now. There's another one they hold in. That's New Orleans. But yeah, you're talking about the one. They have the ham radio equipment, and yeah, they got everything wrong. Everything wrong. But at least they brought it up, you know. And yeah, the one guy never had a call sign. He just had a handle, and he knew all about it. But yeah, you know, he couldn't have been a ham radio operator. Yes, I did see that one.
Yeah, this was the original NCIS, and they kind of treated amateur radio operators the way they used to treat computer hackers, that they were all just kind of overaged young men living in their mother's basements and such, as all a bunch of antisocial people. It was very annoying, that particular episode. I'm waiting for NCIS in some landlocked state where somehow the Navy is concerned about crime. Unfortunately, my geography isn't good, but there's got to be some wonderfully landlocked state that has absolutely nothing to do with the Navy, and I'm sure if it was a reasonable plot, they would put up a new NCIS version for that.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, they got one for New Orleans. I like the original and the one in California. They're pretty good. I know they go way off base, but at least they have this microwave thing on. They brought that up. And they even mentioned Prey. I was happy to hear that.
Okay, so at least they're staying topical. But my money, and I know Lou, who's out there, because he piped up recently, was very interested in this subject when we were talking about the Journal of American Medical Association article and the concussion experts who kind of thought that it was consistent with a concussion, although they couldn't find any hard radiological evidence for anything going on. I still think it's a conversion problem. There's a lot of that that goes around that's thankfully underreported, because the best way of treating any kind of mass hysteria is to calm people down. If you choose not to calm people down, I still remember when I was an intern, a young woman whose family was almost hysterical that she was going to have a seizure. And basically, I saw the family in the room winding her up so much until she hyperventilated, and sure enough, she had a seizure. So hysteria, it's not that it's not a real thing. It's a very real thing. But you have to know how to address it. If you feed hysteria, you just get more hysteria. That's my two cents worth.
Very good, Corey. That's what they make Valium for. Oh, wait, I don't think you're allowed to give that anymore. But they gotta give us something after that. All right, I'll let you continue, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, Paul, Valium is still alive and well. It's not an opiate, so it's not part of the great opium scare that unfortunately a lot of people are dying who've never died before, primarily because of the synthetic morphine called fentanyl, which is much more powerful than any other opiate and has a much lower toxic level, where you can kill more people with less of the stuff. So unfortunately, it's not good stuff, and it's being shipped to us all over the place. I don't really think it's being thrown over walls or over borders. It's pretty much going Matter of fact, I think a lot of it is actually coming in through the mail from China. So along with those Baofengs and those $80 base stations, I guess there's fentanyl. Who knows? Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments, and then I'll go on to the next item.
ACQIS, a question about fentanyl.
Sure. Ask.
You made it sound as if the fentanyl and not that I guess a different demographic of people are now taking drugs. Is it your opinion or is it not your opinion that a lot of this problem stems from overprescription of medication? AC2IS.
Once again, my answer unfortunately sounds like it's complicated, because it's complicated. Yes, the doctors overprescribe. Patients ask them and plead with them and want the pain to go away, and some doctors find it easier to just write a prescription and they stop complaining. I didn't like doing that generally and still don't. I have had patients who kind of went off to rheumatology specialist and came back addicted to actually fentanyl. He put the poor old woman. She was about 89 years old, and at 89, already addicted to fentanyl by this rheumatologist, I was between a rock and a hard place, because I don't want to see a 90-year-old woman go through detox. But it's a multi-pronged problem, because you have doctors over-prescribing, you have patients over-demanding, you have pharmaceutical companies throwing these things left, right, and center and not really looking too close. When a small town that has maybe 2,000 people in their population are selling 3 million pills a year, and then you have the illicit traffic that comes in through through different ports over the United States. So, like anything, it's complicated, it's multifactorial, and everyone's a little bit to blame, and some more than others.
AC2IS here. I agree. I think there's a lot of sort of marketing of these painkillers, and that I think, unfortunately, doctors are probably not equipped to sort of see through the marketing and maybe prescribe based on actual need. There probably is an increased demand that people are looking for painkillers. It's probably an increased rate of prescription, but I guess I'm looking to hear you verify that. Say 20 years ago, you don't think that these things were being marketed as heavily, you don't think that patients were demanding it as much, and you don't think it was being prescribed as much, or do you think that a lot of drug taking had been going on and it's only just becoming more lethal now? AC2IS.
Well, like everything, there are ages for all kinds of different products. In the 60s, Valiums that were mentioned were very popular and abused. In the 70s and the early 80s, Quaaludes were overprescribed and abused. Then in the 90s, Adderall and different amphetamines were abused. So you have these different cycles of medicinal abuse. Somewhat, again, it's from the pharmaceutical companies who are promoting and marketing. It's doctors who just want their patients to not be unhappy and complain to them. And it's society of what they'll tolerate and what they won't. Now, back in the 1980s, opiate use was somewhat restricted. Some would say kind of semi-ridiculously. If you had a person with end-stage cancer who was going to have maybe about 3 weeks or 2 months or something to live, the concerns of turning a terminal cancer patient into a drug addict is non-existent, in my humble opinion. But there would still be guys out there who would limit the pain medication severely just as they would rightfully limit the pain medication for people who weren't terminal. So the pendulum was swung too much in the other direction in around 1980, and unfortunately, like many things, it swung too far the other end. Again, with the help of pharmaceutical companies that marketed incredibly strong synthetic materials.
So you think that drug abuse was going on at fairly similar rates, say, 20, 30 years ago compared to today, and it's just that nowadays it's more lethal and the bodies are piling up more? AC2IS.
Well, it's difficult to really pin down numbers of people who didn't get caught or didn't end up in emergency rooms. But things like Valium and even Quaaludes have a much higher toxic level. You got to work a little bit harder. With fentanyl, you don't really have to work at all to almost kill yourself. So, I mean, you could make a laundry list of famous people who've killed themselves taking fentanyl. It's a terrible, terrible situation. So I think that generally human beings tend to gravitate towards mind-altering substances, unfortunately, for a whole bunch of different reasons. And I think this present trend is just to an incredibly toxic choice on their part. Not that I would suggest that they switch to cocaine or Quaaludes or Valium or such, but it's just... It's a very dangerous new drug that has a very narrow therapeutic, very wide terminal toxic level.
All right, thanks for that info. No further comment from me, AC2IS.
Okey-doke, on to the next. China appears to have beaten the U.S. in the race to mount a real gun on a battleship, as Popular Mechanics reported December 31st. Real guns were devices that use electromagnetic forces to hurl projectiles over long distances, beating them on much faster than gunpowder-based weapons of similar size. They're useful if you want to kill a lot of people far away from you before you have time to detect they have time to detect that you shot at them. They're particularly useful for Navy warfare, where most of the killing is accompanied by destroying the big machine your enemy is riding around in before your enemy can destroy your big death machine. So, they would be particularly useful for that, except that it's quite difficult to get one of them to work. Now, real guns, as reported in August by the USNI News, published by a nonprofit U.S. Naval Institute, require very large capacity batteries. In addition, their barrels tend to fall apart. The U.S. hasn't yet managed to make one with a battery small enough or a barrel sturdy enough for it to be installed on a warship, though it's been trying for more than a decade now. The Chinese Navy, it seems, has beaten the U.S. to the punch, although, as Popular Mechanics noted, it's not actually clear whether the Chinese real gun works. Now, according to news reports, a Chinese naval ship called the Yangshan, sporting a seeming real gun on its bow, was spotted leaving the Yangtze River for testing in the Pacific. This is on a certain level a big deal, because both countries' giant seaborne killing machines have been menacing one another in the South China Sea lately. So does it all work that way, or...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, unfortunately, probably the person who would like the real gun story the most is good old John Silent Key, KC2WGB. May he rest in peace. He built his own real gun. He would have probably liked that little article and had much to say, but that's life. Anyway, let me drop for a second, and then I'll move on to the next article. Okay, the Wireless Electromagnetic Method project took 13 years to build, but the researchers said that it was finally ready to emit extremely low-frequency radio waves, also known as ELF waves. Those waves have dubiously been linked cancer by the World Health Organization, affiliated International Agency for Research on Cancer. Now, although the project has civilian applications, officially it will be used for earthquake and mineral protection and form part of China's 11th five-year plan, it will play a crucial role in military communications. Scientists said that its transmissions could be picked up by a submarine lurking hundreds of yards under the sea, thus reducing the vessel's risk of having to resurface to receive transmission. The project follows the construction of the China's first military-grade super low-frequency station back in 2009. The next year, a Chinese nuclear submarine successfully communicated with the station from deep water, making China the third country in the world to have established such a submarine communication system after the United States and Russia. Let me drop for a second. But Chinese Navy is eager to expand its capacity and has been pouring research into the more advanced ELF radio technology, which allows submarines to communicate with the command center from a greater depth and is harder to disrupt. The Chinese government, however, has played down the importance of the facility, which occupies some 1,400 square miles of land, in information released to the public. Apart from the need to protect an important strategic asset, some researchers said that the secrecy was to avoid causing public alarm. The antenna would emit ELF signals with a frequency of between 0.1 to 300 hertz, the researchers said. The exact site of the facility has not been disclosed. Information available in Chinese research journals suggests it is in the Huanghong region, area in central China that includes Hubei, Henan, and Hunan provinces, and is home to more than 230 million people, greater than the population of all of Brazil. Project WAM's mixed surface structure is a pair of high-voltage power supply lines stretching from north to south, east to west, on steel lattice towers, which form a cross that is 37 miles wide and 50 to 62 miles long. Let me drop for a second. At the end of each power line, thick copper wires go underground through a deep borehole. Two power stations generate strong currents and electrify the ground in slow repeating pulses, turning the earth.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With a range of up to 2,200 miles, according to the project scientist. A sensitive receiver within that range, which is roughly the distance between China and Singapore or Guam, would be able to pick up these signals. The radar will be difficult for spy satellites to detect, they say, because it will appear no different to an ordinary power grid, although radar experts said it might be possible to detect its emissions and use those to determine its location. The inland location of the new facility would also make it harder for an enemy to attack compared with a facility located on the coast. A researcher with the Institute of Geology, who's been working on the project, said he did not know its exact location because that information needed a high level of security clearance, which apparently he did not have. This facility will have important military uses, he said. If a war breaks out, though I am involved in the project, I have no idea where it is. It should be up and running by now, he said. But the project has caused concerns among some academics who worry about the possible impact on public health. Let me drop for a second. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, part of the World Health Organization, has previously warned that ELF waves are possibly carcinogenic to humans. Numerous epidemiological and experimental studies conducted by researchers around the world supposedly have linked long-term ELF exposure to an increased risk of childhood leukemia. In a 500-page report constantly updated since 2007, the World Health Organization has documented a large number of academic investigations linking ELF radiation to a range of illnesses, including delusions, sleep deprivation, stress, depression, breast and brain tumors, miscarriages, and suicide. Though many of the results remain inconclusive, the World Health Organization and said that the implementation of precautionary procedures to reduce exposure was reasonable and warranted. Let me drop for a second. Scientists involved declined to comment on the impact the facility would have on residents' health. The Ministry of Ecology and Environment, for instance, asked for a comprehensive review on its environmental impact, a request that has not been granted. The money came from civilian budgets, they say, but the military has intervened due to the ministry's complaints that a Peking-based researcher who asked not to be named due to the sensitivity of the issue. The ministry did not respond to a request for comment. So according to one calculation by the Chinese Navy, a person standing on the emission site would be subject to ELF radiation no greater than 10 watts, enough to power up several LED light bulbs. According to China's safety standards, only radiation greater than 300 watts is considered harmful. So the project will cause no harm to staff and residents in surrounding areas. It is not necessary to build extra facilities for the purpose of health protection. One of the scientists wrote in an article in the Chinese language research journal Ship Science and Technology in 2016. Let me drop for a second. One of the engineers said the project would be given an exemption from supervision by environmental authorities. The researcher with the Institute of Earthquake Forecasting, who was directly involved in the project, but informed about it, said that the relevant authorities had recently conducted final checks on the emission site and concluded it was ready for operation. There should be some devices monitoring the environment on the site for the protection of the public health, that particular scientist said. China is not the first country doing this. Other countries conducted similar projects long ago. In 1968, the U.S. Navy proposed Project Sanguine, a giant RF antenna that would have covered two-fifths of the state of Wisconsin to enable undersea communications with submarines. Let me drop for a second. The project was terminated due to a massive protest by residents. The U.S. Navy then built a smaller transmitter, the Wisconsin Test Facility, with two 28-mile power lines in the Clam Lake area, a place with a low population density. The station emitted ELF waves at 76 Hertz and was decommissioned over a decade ago. In the 1980s, the Soviet Union constructed Zev, a considerably more powerful facility in the Kola Peninsula inside the Arctic Circle. The Zev's antenna was powered by two 37-mile electric lines that had a main frequency tuned at 82 Hertz. The radio waves it produced were believed powerful enough to reach Russian nuclear submarines hidden deep under the Arctic ice cap. Russia has since provided technical support to China as it started building its own system, which may include other ELF stations in coastal areas. According to the World Health Organization, an ELF field can affect human nerve fibers and stimulate synaptic transmissions and neural networks. It can also affect retina cells, generating a sporadic flash of light in people's eyes. Animals can use low-frequency signals to detect threats, changes in surrounding environment, an ability critical for survival of nature, according to some biologists, and experiments suggest that ELF radiation could also have an effect on cattle. A professor with the Department of Electrical Energy at Nanao University said the ELF radio was unlikely to cause acute damage to the human body due to its enormous wavelength, which would stretch over thousands of kilometers, but it might interfere with the sensory organs. Now, some previous studies had shown that wounds heal more slowly when exposed to ELF radio waves several times a day, the guy added. The gentleman also has taken part in numerous military research projects and said that the environmental impact of defense-related facilities was usually not scrutinized as much as civilian projects. Let me drop for a second. Said the matter must be handled with extreme caution, or it can easily lead to public panic. He said the authorities in charge of the WEM project should recruit a large number of volunteers for comparison studies, although that's probably not going to happen. The sample size must be sufficiently large because of variations in the environment and timing of the individuals involved could produce different results. Some people are more sensitive, he said. They can see or hear things other people can't. They may be more vulnerable to the impact. Researchers also said that the facility would also have a peacetime application and be used to detect mineral and oil deposits. Ground stations with special equipment can pick up signals to survey underground structures to an unprecedented depth. The ELF waves will also be able to detect rock deformities, which could help in studying precursors for major earthquakes. In 20